From PCJ Radio International, welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. This past week, there were a number of summits happening across the Asia Pacific. We're going to begin first with APEC. Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott met the Chinese President Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the APEC summit in Bali, Indonesia, with the pair agreeing to increase trade between the two countries. The Prime Minister lauded China's power, saying it would benefit the world and it should embrace it, and Mr. Xi welcomed his enthusiasm over stronger ties. It is understood that Mr. Abbott also accepted an invitation to visit China next year, and he wants to take business and trade representatives with him. Mr. Abbott is still to meet leaders from countries including Thailand, Canada, Singapore, and Mexico, as well as the U.S. Secretary of State. For more, here's George Roberts from Indonesia.
This is what a $125 billion hello looks like. The value of trade between Australia and China surges by the year. So does the political outreach between their leaders.
China's growing strength is a benefit to the world, not a challenge. Certainly, we in Australia owe much of our prosperity to the rapidly growing trade relations between our two countries.
Tony Abbott is keen to lock down a free trade deal with Beijing. President Xi agrees negotiations could go faster. He's invited the Prime Minister to make an official visit. It will happen in the first half of next year.
China and Australia entering into closer cooperation not only serves common interests, but will also add positive attitudes to the region.
This is the Prime Minister's first ascent to the summit of a multinational leaders' gathering. He's making the most of it. Meetings are scheduled with economically and politically powerful partners over the next 2 days.
That was George Roberts reporting from Indonesia. We now leave APEC and move to ASEAN. 18 leaders are attending the East Asia Summit in Brunei and went into formal talks on Thursday, with trade and regional security likely to dominate discussions. The annual meeting brings together 10 members of the Southeast Asian group ASEAN, plus 8 other nations, including the United States, China, and India. Australia's Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, of course, was among those attending. Naomi Woodley has more.
For the second time this week, Tony Abbott joined other leaders for a gala dinner and cultural performance, this time at the East Asia Summit. The summit itself doesn't officially start until today, with the main session a closed forum where leaders will make a short speech on a topic of their choosing. Tony Abbott is expected to speak of the need for ongoing discussions about regional security issues, as well as the potential for closer financial ties and cooperation on challenges like combating malaria and natural disasters.
Prime Minister,
hello. How are you?
I'm very well. Lovely to see you again.
As with the APEC talks earlier this week, Mr. Abbott is also holding side discussions with a range of his counterparts. And while this summit does not have trade at its centrepiece, it has been a feature of those bilateral meetings.
Thank you so much, Mr. Premier.
After meeting the Chinese president in Bali on Sunday, Mr. Abbott has now also held formal talks with the Premier, Li Keqiang.
I want to work with you, Mr. Prime Minister, to further advance the strategic partnership between China and Australia. And I also want to use today's opportunity to once again express my congratulations to you on your election as the Prime Minister of Australia.
Thank you so much for your congratulations, and may I extend mine to you and say how pleased I am to be having this meeting and how pleased I was to be able to meet with President Xi in Bali just the other day.
After the pleasantries, it's understood they also discussed the ongoing dispute over territory in the South China Sea, but without any apparent breakthrough. Tony Abbott also pushed for progress on free trade agreements when he met his Japanese and South Korean counterparts in separate meetings. He's expected to meet the Indian Prime Minister today before flying home to Australia.
Naomi Woodley reporting. Just as talks began in Brunei with the annual ASEAN summit, the group is now discussing who will take over the leadership of the 10-nation bloc. Myanmar's name has come up. recognizing the growing acceptance of the former military dictatorship within ASEAN. But this is causing some controversy, as we hear from Zoe Daniel.
This is the last ASEAN summit of the year, and the chairmanship of ASEAN will now be taken over by Myanmar. And that's despite continuing concerns about human rights abuses in the country, but it is an endorsement of the reform process so far under the leadership of President Thein Sein. He, in fact, is nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, and that'll be announced in the next few days. Several dozen political prisoners were released on the eve of the summit, and that's in line with an undertaking by the president that all prisoners of conscience will be released by the end of the year. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott flew in from APEC in Bali and went straight into a meeting with the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Tony Abbott described Japan as Australia's best friend in Asia, and he invited the Prime Minister to come to Australia as soon as is practical. The Japanese Prime Minister accepted. Tony Abbott was also invited to go to Japan because Shinzo Abe says that he'd like to elevate the relationship with Australia in line with his good relationship with previous Prime Minister John Howard. And Tony Abbott indicated that he will visit Japan in early 2014.
That was Zoe Daniel reporting. We now move to another big story that was in the headlines in Southeast Asia. A state funeral will be held this weekend for one of Vietnam's best-known 20th century figures. He died at age 102. General Von Nianggap is credited for staging the historic defeat of the French at the Dien Bien Phu in 1954 and the subsequent communist victory over the U.S.-backed South Vietnamese 2 decades later. News of his death first broke on social media. Next, Sam Lam speaks to Carly Timer, a professor from the University of New South Wales in Australia, about his legacy.
Oh, absolutely. Not only, as we all know, did he defeat the French at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu and lead to the expulsion of the French there, but he's widely credited with masterminding the Vietnamese grand strategy as it opposed the United States in the Vietnam War from 1965 onwards, and for the air defense of Vietnam during the air war period. And the Vietnamese government, to shore up its nationalist legitimacy, has given great prominence to General Zap, both on the anniversary of each of those major events.
And how do you think history will remember him? What would you say would be his main achievement?
Well, the history will be remembered, I think, differently by communist authorities and scholars from outside the country. Within Vietnam, he'll be the victor of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu on land. That's 1954, and in the air, 1972, with the B-52 bombings of Vietnam. And he will be portrayed as a grand strategist, a nationalist, a patriot, who believed in people's war, used the common peasant, used the weak to defeat the strong, used the old weapons, rudimentary weapons, to defeat the more modern. So it's a kind of narrative of Vietnam's standing up to foreign aggressors far and near, China today, France, the U.S. in the past. But the other history of General Zap is one of having faced continued infighting within the party of his background, of his military strategy, of his advocacy of being close to the United States towards the end of his life, and more particularly, remarkably, several years ago, for his intervention in a hot dispute over Chinese bauxite mining in the Central Highlands, where he opposed it on environmental security grounds, and more tellingly, national security grounds. And he gave support and cover for a large environmentalist and political activist movement that was concerned by these developments.
Bon Nguyen Zap, as you say, was much respected as a military genius, but there is more light and shade to the story than outsiders realize, isn't there? Tell us about his mistakes.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the communist system and its historians are one that like to portray the victories and successes. But in fact, he wasn't formally militarily trained. And in 1951, he led a conventional attack against French forces in the Red River Delta that were fortified. And he suffered great losses. Well, he learned from that. And then he used the siege at Dien Bien Phu to win. One of the criticisms, though, is that throughout his career, he had extraordinary casualty rates, using the great numbers of Vietnamese to achieve victory.
Indeed, the later U.S. General William Westmoreland said any American general who took the same amount of losses as Zap did would have been sacked. Did Zap sacrifice soldiers' lives recklessly, do you think?
Well, I think in the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, there was an urgency because a conference just to settle the fate of peace in the Far East was going to now include Indochina And he delivered that victory on the day the conference opened, so it had a great effect. But elsewhere, you know, making that balance, that was an asset that Vietnam had. America had the firepower and mobility, so you have to juxtapose the two. Certainly Westmoreland couldn't have taken those casualties, and definitely no Australian commander. Australians even were more cautious than the U.S. So it's hard in that balance to say how he could have used the assets of those numbers differently to defeat, say, a more technologically equipped America that was much more mobile.
You mentioned that Bo Ninh Xep had no formal military training. So did he operate as a soldier and indeed as a strategist mainly through instinct and experience?
Yes, and that's what the Vietnamese like, combining ideology with practice. I mean, he did spend some time in China and was acquainted with Mao's theories of revolutionary warfare. But Vietnam had also had its own tradition of peasant being called up into defense of the nation, particularly during times of Chinese invasion. So he combined traditional military art, the villager who became a part-time guerrilla or soldier in historic times.
As you say, General Xep helped defeat the U.S.-backed regime in South Vietnam. But was he a polarizing figure all the same in Vietnam, at least during the latter part of the 20th century?
Well, he was polarizing because of internal party factionalism. He ceased having operational control around 1973, 75. So after unification, he just retained the position as Minister of Defense. Vietnam was in a parlous state and hadn't yet adopted its reforms. He was a strong candidate to become party secretary general, but didn't succeed. And there are divisions in Vietnam between the ideologues and the proletariat-inclined people and General Xep. So he was a controversial figure inside the party, but was allowed to serve on until 80 or so, and then was finally removed from the Politburo and ceased being Minister of National Defense. So his legacy is really of an earlier period, although he lived so long. I think most Vietnamese who are anti-communist, yes, they wouldn't revere his memory and would talk about, you know, his ruthless use of conscription and manpower. But I don't think they personalized it. It was just the Northern Army and the Northern communist system. And in fact, as we now know, that General Xep wasn't, although he was a loyal member of the party, he did have disagreements about invading Cambodia, about the Tet Offensive, and about relations with the U.S. He was in advance of thinking at that time.
And just briefly, what about the younger generation of leaders in Vietnam? How do they view Bo Ninh Xep?
Well, one, I think like everybody, as a founding father and the person that defeated the French, he gets full credit for that. Go into any major bookshop in Vietnam, they've gathered all his Vietnamese material in massive volumes, but because he was getting on in age. So he's left a huge legacy to be studied that will be used. But the generation today is not one at war, not one of foreign attack, and is kind of divorced from it. But he'll be seen, I think, by all Vietnamese as a national hero. And as I say, on those days, the day you celebrate the victory over the French, the day unification of Vietnam, defeating the American B-52 aerial campaign, December 72, each of those occasions, his figure, his aura, his legacy will be brought up. And I think the Vietnamese will take pride in that. And in the South, I think we've gone through the reaction to Northern domination, to a country that's outward-looking and modernizing. So he's just a historic figure that every country has. That's part of what will be taught in the schools, and that will be respected.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The global head of the Ahmadiyya Islamic Group community has used a visit to Australia to highlight the persecution of his followers in some parts of Asia. Mirza Masroor Ahmad is visiting Australia for the first time since 2006. He used the trip to reiterate concerns that the conflict in Syria could spread further. Bill Bertels has the story.
For Ahmadi Muslims, seeing their spiritual leader is a rare and special opportunity. This year's visit to Australia by Mirza Masroor Ahmad, known as the Caliph of Ahmadiyya, was his first to the country in 6 years. The tight-knit community only has around 5,000 followers in Australia, but the sect claims tens of millions of followers around the world, a figure which is difficult to determine. During a visit to a mosque in Sydney's west over the weekend, Ahmad used the opportunity to warn that conflict in Syria could spiral out of control if major powers get involved.
Even just recently, 3-4 weeks before, I delivered a sermon, and my sermon is translated into 7-8 more languages. Therein I explained clearly that both parties, government in of this Syrian situation, government and the public should behave in a way which is human. They have already ruined this, the peace of their country, but they will just, they are going to doom their country. And moreover, this will spread to the region. And there is a fear, I am scared, that it can spread even all across the world. And it can be the cause of the Third World War.
The Ahmadiyyas have long rejected extremism and say true Islam involves promoting peace. Mirza Masroor Ahmad says if the international community worked together, it could stop extremism in Syria and other places.
You see, these fundamentalism is always there, and they are not in majority. But the question is, none of these organizations or Muslim countries have any arsenal or armament industry. Where from they are getting it? Obviously, from the West. Either it is from Eastern Europe or from through other way, underhand dealing. I don't know how. That is what I have been telling all the time to the politicians. So if you want to control, the big powers want to control, they can control these extremists. They are, you know, they don't have oil money. Somebody who has oil money or some wealthier nations are helping them. This is why they are running their, you know, this notorious task.
But the main focus for the spiritual leader is his religious community. Many members are greatly concerned about long-standing legal persecution against Ahmadis in the country where the sect originated from, Pakistan.
2010, in two of our mosques, almost 90 people were killed and hundreds of them were injured. And every off and on, even every after 1 or 2 weeks, I received the news of one or two Ahmadis being murdered or martyred.
So this is ongoing?
Yes, ongoing process, yes. And it can never stop unless that obnoxious law is there and that exists.
Ahmad says sporadic mob violence spurred on by Muslim clerics in Indonesia also continues to affect the community.
In certain areas where the administration is against us, they are creating problem. And Mullah is also very much furious there. Whenever they get chance, they raise hue and cry, and not only hue and cry, they raise arms, and they can go up to any extent they can. This is why some time ago, three of our Ahmadis were beaten to death in the mosque.
Mirza Masroor Ahmad is continuing his Australian visit this week before heading to New Zealand, then Japan, before returning to London, where he lives in exile from Pakistan.
That was Bill Birtles reporting. Finally, let me ask you a question. What country do you think has the largest TV audience in the world? Some of you may be saying India. Some of you may be saying Russia. Some of you may be saying the United States. Well, you're actually all wrong. The largest television audience in the world is China. Professor Ying Zhu from the Department of Media Culture at the University of New York in the United States has just written a comprehensive book published by New Press. The book is entitled 2 Billion Eyes, The Story of China Central Television. It's a fascinating read because 2 billion eyes equals 1 billion people. CCTV is also the largest television network in the world, with a local staff in China alone of around 14,000 people. She speaks next to Richard Ady. The first question he asked her was about media freedom within CCTV.
It depends. And obviously, the topics that would put, you know, the party leadership in a negative light would not be covered by CCTV news.
So you're talking about individuals?
Individuals. For instance, the New York Times covered the massive amount of fortune amassed by the top leaders, right? And news like these would not be covered by CCTV.
Yes, the former premier, his family, Wen Jiabao, had a huge, it turned out, had a huge fortune. And CCTV didn't go anywhere near it, is that right?
That's right. It wouldn't dare to.
So how does that work in practice? Because I'm wondering if there are essentially journalists pushing to do stories and censors telling them they can't, essentially within the same organisation.
Yeah, it's a delicate dance. And so it's constant negotiation. And this gets to the heart of the issue concerning control and censorship in Chinese journalism. And so over the years, the party has tried to relax its grip because it started to do a little more sophisticated PR campaign. And knowing that strict censorship would not sit too well. So over the years, while it loosens its control, it really downshifted the burden of censorship onto each individual production teams and individual journalists.
Mm. And it does, I suppose, illustrate better than anything else the paradox at the heart of this organisation. It has to do three things. So it has to bring news and, I suppose, Chinese culture to that massive audience that it has. It still has to be, it's still required to be sometimes a sort of mouthpiece for the party. And it has to make money. It has commercial imperatives that it must meet.
Yes. The state and the market have pretty much formed an alliance to advance the kind of programs that are both ideologically inoffensive or politically correct and also commercially successful, which CCTV is required to deliver. And so the end result is frequently a sanitized version of entertainment program and also politically safe news programs. Mm.
But you spoke to the program makers, you spoke to the journalists. Is there a sense of frustration at them feeling that they either have to hold themselves back or that they are being held back?
Well, absolutely, absolutely. You know, however cautious in their deliberation to me, and you can sense this, the kind of depression, frustration is quite rampant among CCTV's news practitioners.
But there was a big, important event. You talk about the earthquake in Sichuan, I think it was in 2008. Now, that was a kind of redefining moment for their news coverage, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was, and this was the first time the CCTV reported this major disaster with speed and with frankness. Essentially, this becomes a milestone in CCTV's development. The very swift reporting was in sharp contrast to the habitual cover-up of the past. As we all know, that domestic disasters of any sort used to be highly guarded secrets by the very macho, a militant state in fear of projecting a weak national image. And so the speed and frankness of this earthquake report by CCTV, is very unprecedented, surprising everybody, including Western media, especially in light of the fact that during the run-up to the Olympics, that was in 2008, the Chinese media had been tightly controlled and packaged by the government. So it was a delightful surprise when it happened.
And did covering that earthquake, that terrible tragedy in Sichuan, actually permanently change the approach of their journalists and news part of the organisation?
I wouldn't say permanently changed it. It's temporarily CCTV had this window of opportunity to act upon their journalistic instinct, professional instinct, to do this kind of reporting. And the window of opportunity was short-lived. I think, several things contributed to the coverage, to this kind of very swift coverage at the time. You know, by 2008, disaster reporting had gradually become less of a taboo because of the rapid flow of information across the national border. And there's no way you can block information from flowing in and out.
Mm.
10 years ago, the SARS cover-up of 2003 was disastrous. It turned the citizens away from the state-run media as they desperately sought out alternative and overseas news sources. So the Chinese state came to the kind of realization that too much information management or censorship could turn a natural disaster into a credibility crisis. So they were mindful of this.
So when it came to Sichuan, because, I mean, a lot of the disaster of it wasn't just the massive earthquake. It was things like the slowness of rescue efforts and the shoddiness of construction, especially of schools, that resulted in so many children dying. How critical was CCTV able to be about those things it was finding out?
It was difficult for them to cover, really get to the heart of these issues or the various factors that had led to the building collapse at schools within earthquake boundary. So in this way, its coverage, even though, however speedy and frank, it did not really go all the way to these real sensitive issues. So it really still held itself back.
Now, I want to ask you about a program that used to be on CCTV and it isn't anymore. It's News Probe, which was a nighttime TV current affairs show, kind of created in the mold of 60 Minutes. And this is back in the 90s. And it had four guidelines. Now, one of them was a spirit of questioning, perspective of equality, a sense of balance. And this is the one that I think will slightly flummox journalists in America or Australia, and that is a sense of equilibrium. Now, what did that mean?
It means that, yes, you can report critically about certain events, but the end, you know, result or end goal, the purpose of which, of being critical, is to bring in, you know, positive reinforcement. In other words, you know, criticism is not to provoke discontent, but to ultimately bringing in an order and to reinforce the national unity. So that's what equilibrium means in this context.
And for a while, the program, the show did pretty well, didn't it?
Yes, it did. The goal was to do more in-depth news stories, bring in objectivity and so on, and it did extremely well. But when, once the criticism pushed certain hot buttons of the, you know, the party establishments, both local establishments and the central party establishment pushed back. So News Probe had to ring in itself.
And that was that eventually, wasn't it?
That's right. And so it changed its mandate from doing in-depth investigative program to use the term by its producer Zhang Jie to do an enlightenment program, which means that, you know, the journalism or the functions of News Probe is to enlighten Chinese people about citizenry.
Professor Ying Zhu from the University of New York, from the Department of Media Culture, talking about her new book, 2 Billion Eyes, The Story of China Central Television, published by The New Press. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Listeners in East and Southeast Asia can catch another edition with Andy Sennett at 1330 UTC on 11835 kHz. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Pelo, wishing you well. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.